It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. From the land down under to the Steel City, the new director of the Carnegie Museum of Natural History, Eric Dorfman, comes to Pittsburgh fresh off of a stint at a museum and observatory in New Zealand. He's also written a book called The Future of Natural History Museums and joins us to explain what led him to the Berg and discuss his plans for the future of the Carnegie. Eric Dorfman, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello, Paul.
And if you'd like to join the conversation, if you have a comment or question about the museum, if you remember visits there as a kid, maybe you just happened to go there recently and were wondering about some of the changes that are being put in place, this is the man to direct your comments and questions to. If you would like to join our conversation with Eric Dorfman, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Eric Dorfman, what initially sparked your interest in the field of natural history?
Well, I've always loved animals, but I can bring it down to one very critical event, which was at a science center, actually, in Los Angeles. I was probably about 3 years old, and I was watching chicks hatch, and little chickens hatch out of an egg. And somehow that image has stayed with me all the time. But I've always, even as a tiny kid, loved ants and butterflies and birds and everything. And
You grew up in California.
I did. I grew up in California in the Bay Area. So and I've just always had this real passion. And then of course David Attenborough has been a real influence, and so was Jacques Cousteau back in the day. Early on, I had the chance to raise animals in the backyard, and my parents were extremely indulgent. I had all kinds of things.
What'd you have back there?
Oh, we had a goat and a pony and a bunch of rabbits and chickens, and it was pretty crowded. So, and inside were fish and mice and hamsters, cats, a dog. So it was a little bit of a Dr. Doolittle growing up, but I've never lost that. And when I had the chance to study it professionally, getting a master's working on porpoises in California, and then a PhD working on water birds in Australia, I've never lost that relationship. And of course, the other thing is that as I became more aware of what's happening in the world, the whole conservation part of natural history has been a real passion.
And I read that you had to make a choice between being an opera singer,
yes,
and that's right, doing the work that you're doing now.
That's right.
How and tough a choice was that?
That was extremely tough. And I tried for a number of years in college. I went to UC San Diego to do both, and it came down to one fateful chemistry exam that I knew I could either stay home and study, or I could go to a dress rehearsal for a production. And in the end, I had to make the tough decision to pass chemistry, and and really that turned on the light, and I had to say, well, I can do one as a hobby and one as a one as a profession. And so I have sung from time to time, but really I'm pretty happy with my decision.
I'm sure the director wasn't, but
no that was another conversation.
But yeah, I'm sure. But at the same time, who could blame you for wanting to pass your chemistry?
Well, exactly.
So yeah. Describe your experience acting as director of the Whanganui Regional Museum and Ward Observatory in New Zealand.
That was, I will compliment you on your accent. So Whanganui, that's the right way to say it. So yeah, I had was a marvelous time. I was there just shy of 5 years, and it's a beautiful small museum. It's one of the major museum collections in New Zealand, which focuses on natural history, Maori cultural history, and sort of colonial history of the area. So really beautiful collection, and it's claim to fame, really, in recent years has been the world's biggest moa collection. And moa was the largest bird that ever existed, sort of a relative of an ostrich, but much, much bigger, the biggest ones. And so we did a lot of work getting that out in front of the public. We put in a beautiful gallery around it. But for me, the biggest thing that stays with me is the connection to the community and taking a museum that on some levels may have been perceived as a little bit rarefied, a little bit only for the intelligentsia, and making that much more pertinent, relevant to the community, especially Maori community. They're, you know, they're the indigenous people of New Zealand, and a lot of our artifacts came from their ancestors. And so making that a really relevant experience for people was really for me something that I'm very proud of. And also during my time there, we took over Ward Observatory, and that was also a thing. I guess the biggest success we had there was in my time of the just under 5 years, we quadrupled visitations. So that was also, I think, partly because we made it a lot more welcoming.
Can you apply some of those lessons to your new job at the Carnegie? Because clearly they are looking to increase visitation.
Absolutely.
The museum has lost money in recent years. So clearly that's something that they're looking for you and to you to do.
Absolutely. One of the things, and of course, the visitation isn't where you start. It's for me about making it welcoming and making it relevant. And those two things, I think, set the groundwork for visitation to flow on.
What do you, what do you mean when you say making it relevant? I mean, I remember being a kid going to that museum.
Yeah.
And you weren't thinking about, oh, is this relevant or not? You just
thought,
cool.
But if you engage with it, that's the thing. We may be sitting there at the museum saying, how is this relevant for people? You're not having to say that. You're having an emotional reaction to it. And also the topics that we cover are things that I certainly hope that people would respond to. If every person goes in there and they have a reaction like I did when I was 4 years old and watching these chicks hatch, something that I feel was there for me. That's so, for instance, somebody I was talking to, their wife loves to come in and look at these huge fish, the skeleton fish from 65 million years ago. And that's her thing. She just loves them. If we can create
what
those
does a skeleton fish look like?
Well, it's huge. It's I don't know, sort of 6-7 feet long with huge teeth and big plates on its head. It's if you know where the dinosaurs are, and then there's the kind of the ocean part. It's sitting in a window between the two.
Okay.
So it's they're pretty impressive. I wouldn't want to be swimming with one.
Yeah, right.
For sure. But
that's the kind of visceral reaction you're talking about.
That's exactly right. If you go, I love to go there and I love to see the gems and minerals, or I love to see the Diplodocus or the Tyrannosaurus Rex, or I love to go. For instance, one of the things that we've made, I think, a real strides in is being relevant to parents with little kids. So we've redone that area that we're calling it Discovery Base Camp, and it's really primarily focused at toddlers and say up to 6 years old. There's a nursing area for mothers in there. There's new things to climb on, these marvelous huge insects. There's boxes you can unpack with furs and little, there we've got new microscopes. There's all this,
this is all brand new. Because there wasn't the hands-on type things that you are now describing there.
The hands-on things that I'm describing now, we've renovated it all. So these we've augmented it and made it. It's very beautiful. It's, I think, really probably the most popular part of the museum right now. And this gets back to that idea of relevance. And you can only be relevant, and this is when I was going to get back to what you were asking before, if you know what people want. And so one of the things that I'm taking from my experience in New Zealand was getting out there and asking people what they want, finding out the key drivers and needs of people. For me, is one of the most important pieces of groundwork that we can do to make a difference in our offer as a visitor experience. So one of the things that we're working on now is a strategy while to have focus groups and increase our survey information so that we can figure out more clearly what it is that people are looking for.
And is this what you would call reinventing the museum experience?
I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but certainly making it more fun, giving it more of a sense of humor as well, I think is, well, why not? You know,
it's interesting to hear you say that, because I remember going through there, and if your parents took you on a Saturday to the Carnegie, you're running around, the dinosaurs right. are just fantastic and amazing.
Yeah.
If you went on a school trip,
some
of those well-trained guides, usually older gentlemen, very, very fine gentlemen, but not so very patient with kids that wanted to run around, touch things.
Absolutely.
Clearly, you are acknowledging the need to do that, to let kids be kids.
That's right. But also let young people be young people. So, for instance, tonight we have one of our Carnegie After Darks, where it's focused on the birds and the bees for Valentine's Day.
Oh, there you go.
And so we've got
what ages are we talking about?
Well, this is 21 plus.
Okay.
So exactly.
Just checking.
That's right. So we'll have a special Valentine's themed cocktail, and there's wine and beer and all kinds of things, because partly what we're trying to do is, and maybe this gets back to what you're saying about reinventing, is thinking about who our audiences are and who potentially could engage with us in a different way. So as we start to renovate all of the exhibitions, not just have temporary ones, but rethink the permanent ones, you'll start to see that we will have a better idea of who wants to use us, who wants to visit, who wants to bring their kids or bring their parents or just come with a date, and how we can cater to each one of those groups.
Before I let you go, Eric, tell us about your book. We've got about 45 seconds here.
Well, that's all right. It's a perfect amount of
time.
Future
of Natural History Museums.
Yes. Now, unfortunately, the message is slightly wrong. We're just starting on that book. It's
okay.
About to come out in 2017.
All right. Certain publication indicated that it was done.
Yes, it was a little premature. Very excited. Yes. Obviously, I'm glad there's a market for it. But I look forward very much to coming back and telling you all about it when it's done.
See, that'll be an excuse to have you here.
I'd love to.
It's been delightful talking with you. So
thank you.
We'll look forward to that. We have been chatting with Eric Dorfman. He is the new director of the Carnegie Museum of Natural History, coming to Pittsburgh via New Zealand, where he was working for several years, and he's been off the continent for quite some time. But we're glad you're back in the USA and here in the Berg.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any portion of the program or would like to revisit past segments, you can go to our website at wesa.fm. Until Monday, I'm Paul Guggenheimer saying have a good weekend, everybody.